So good afternoon and welcome to High Notes. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. We are going to be broadcast on Aspen Public Radio, and I think that broadcast will be tomorrow, Thursday. I am really thrilled to be joined by a great friend of the festival, Jennifer Koh. Jennifer has appeared with us here in Aspen and actually on the road with our Aspen productions. I'm thinking of the DC event. Yes. Someone that we've been hoping to present in Aspen for at least 10 years, and we are so thrilled that she's with us this summer, the great Kaya Sarriaho. Welcome. So first, the commercial. Jennifer will be presenting a recital this evening in Harris Hall, presenting the great D minor partita of Bach, which includes the sensational monumental Chaconne. And then immediately following that with a work that Ms. Sarriaho wrote to follow the D minor partita. So it is a sort of, I guess, sequel would not be the right word, but inspired by, connected to woodwork. And then a tremendous, very theatrical work, which is essentially a violin concerto. It's called Graal Theatre, and by Ms. Sarriaho, and with Jennifer as the soloist, our Aspen Contemporary Ensemble, joined by a number of other students in our program this summer, and Tim Weiss as conductor. So we're going to talk about those works a bit later in this hour. But I thought I would mention that we continue the residency on Friday evening at the 6 p.m. Aspen Chamber Symphony Concert. We will be presenting two major works by Jean Sibelius and two major works by Kaya Sarriaho in a sort of program from Finland. So I thought to establish a little about your work, we would talk about Finland, and you, of course, were a student at the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki, I think around the same time that Esa-Pekka Salonen was also a student there, and the two of you have had a professional friendship as well as a personal friendship for many years. In thinking about Sibelius, I wanted to offer a question to you about his work and perhaps its influence on you. There's a very wonderful essay by Arnold Schoenberg called Brahms the Progressive, and Schoenberg wishes to assert that whereas Brahms was experienced as a very conservative composer in his own time, that his message to the future was actually one that was very progressive, and that Schoenberg himself received as extremely meaningful. And I wondered, Sibelius was considered in the 30s and 40s to be an anti-modernist composer, at least by the modernists. And yet now I think we hear his music in a different way. And I wondered, growing up in Finland, going to the Sibelius Academy, how did the influence of his music reach you?
Well, is this working?
I think it is.
Okay, good. When you grow up in Finland, you don't even realize that Sibelius is not Finland, because the music is everywhere. As a child, you sing his music, you hear it all the time. The first songs for song you learn to know for voice and piano, it's by Sibelius. You hear his music all the time in the concerts. So in fact, I had to grow up and already move away from Finland before I realized how enormous influence he had on me and the whole Finnish music life. And then I, as already as a young composer, I started to, for the first time, really analyzing his music and realized that yes, he had this this reputation of being old-fashioned because of his harmonic language, because there is the big revolution to go out from tonality And he heard his music very, very much tonals. He had different colors for different tonalities. But his formal thinking and his orchestration, they are very, very modern. And in fact, at his time, the conductors didn't even always realize what he was looking for in his orchestration, because he was very inspired by nature. And if you think about it that way, you will hear wind in the woods. And so his orchestration, he deliberately created layers which were melting together, not like in classic orchestration. And some conductors made corrections to him, thinking that he's not doing as we are supposed to do. And then formally, well, you think about his Seventh Symphony, which has been model now for many, many contemporary composers, or his way of creating like puzzles which little by little come together, like some movements in the Fifth Symphony, for example. So, yes, I've realized over the years that I have been very inspired by him.
Now, Jennifer, you play the Sibelius Concerto. I'm not sure there will be much of a connection between the technical demands of that and the technical demands of the works you're doing tonight, but do you have any comment on that?
The Sibelius Concerto. You know, it's actually funny because I think, you know, so many kids learn the Sibelius very young. It's part of standard repertoire, so it was something that I learned probably in my early teens. And I remembered being very, very confused by that piece for a long time because everybody played it very romantically. And what was funny to me was I didn't truly come to a real understanding of it. I don't know if I mentioned this to you, until after I did Graal. And it's not that your piece is like Sibelius necessarily, and it's not like Sibelius is like your piece, but it was weird. And later that season, I think I did Graal in the fall, and then later that season I had a bunch of Sibeliuses, and I finally came to an understanding of that piece. That must have been, I don't know, more than 10 years ago at this point. And so even now people say that I play differently. But I don't think it's a romantic concerto in the sense of Brahms. I think there, even dynamically, I think there are a lot of interesting things that people kind of try to smooth over oftentimes. And I think it's also interesting that often in the Sibelius, the violin's in a different rhythm even than the rest of the orchestra. The third movement, but and almost a different key. And then, like in the middle movement, when finally the orchestra and the violin go into unison, it's quite significant, I think, because we've been in basically different rhythmic values for such a long time, and at times a different, almost different keys. So the emotional, I think, impact of that is quite amazing.
So that idea of the layers in the form is something that's characteristic in the music of yours that we're going to hear, I think.
Layers in textures? Yes. Well, I imagine music very much in a context of different degrees of light and textures, and this is something that just comes to my mind when I think about music. So I think about also very much the depth and the depth of the texture, and in pieces like Graal Theatre, then there are many, many layers of instrumental colors, and the foremost should be always the violin, but sometimes it's melting with the other colors.
I will hope to return to the rhetoric of Grau Theater a little later, but thank you for saying that. Going back to your life, having finished at Sibelius Academy, you moved to Paris and were at IRCAM, which is the Institute for Research in Acoustic and Music. I forget how that works in French. Now, I don't believe Messiaen had a role at IRCAM at all, but I do hear a tremendous influence of Messiaen in your music, and I think there was a story about François d'Assise and your hearing that.
Yes, from Finland I went first to Germany for 2 years, and then from there to Paris. I love French music, yes. I loved it since long time, and I admired Messiaen very much. I could never work with him. He was not so well when I moved to Paris already, but I met him a couple of times. I heard his the world premiere of his opera Saint-François d'Assise in Paris at the Paris Opera, and the music was splendid. It's splendid, but I was disappointed about the stage production, and I felt, oh, this is not opera, this is like oratorio, and I thought it's maybe because of the music, and I felt very disappointed. I thought, wow, if a master like Messiaen cannot write opera, I cannot do it myself. And then I went to Salzburg Festival to see another production, which was production by Peter Sellars. And I don't know, he had found something, and this exactly same music, it had become an opera. And for me, it was unbelievable revelation. I was like, well, okay. So I don't need to take care of everything. I just need to write an opera and then find a good stage director. So so maybe it can work anyway. So I had admired Messiaen before, but because of this thing, having seen how a staging, I was really. It's surprising that how little I had understanding of that thing at that point, even if I had seen many good lot of opera.
I saw the U.S. premiere of that work, which Seiji Ozawa gave in Boston, and it was given as a concert, but Peter Sellars assisted the singers in certain movement, and it was very beautiful. So Jenny, you, a couple of years ago, we were doing something like this, and you told a really marvelous story. It starts with a sad element and then comes in a great arc. I think you were a teenager and you won a prize, which gave you the use of a very wonderful violin.
Oh, no. No. Well, I was very lucky to be loaned an instrument for a long time, for many years. I think for almost 14 years or 15 years. So I had the use of a wonderful instrument for basically most of my kind of adult musical life. And then there became a point where the owner of that instrument wanted to, what is it called, liquefy acids. I had to find another instrument. He was wonderful for many years. Kaya knew about this. Our friend Ansi knew about it. And I was about to buy the wrong instrument. I mean, now looking back, I was about to buy the wrong instrument. But I remember that phone call. I was actually in Berkeley, and I was talking to Kaya. And I was playing the instrument that I thought that I was about to buy. And I remember kept saying, I'm not that happy with it, but maybe that's just the way it is, and maybe it just takes time, or blah, blah, blah. And I feel like you guys just... I remember going to Finland because I felt guilty because you guys had put so much effort into planning everything. But I'd look throughout the U.S. and I'd look throughout the United Kingdom for instruments, and I'd looked for like at least a year and a half, and I looked at a lot of instruments. But I didn't really know the dealers in continental Europe, so they arranged for all these instruments to be sent into Helsinki, and I think I just went, and I really thought I was going to buy this other instrument, and I just went because I felt guilty that they had put effort in, and that's where I met my violin. And then Kaya, and I think there's something wonderful about artists, because it's a really great community to be a part of. And so many of my composer colleagues and friends knew about this entire, well, maybe not from the beginning, but they knew about this whole process because it took 8 years to raise the money, which was really hard and hellish and tortureful. And then a very nice gentleman and his wife stepped in with a very large amount of money at the end. And so this wonderful community of composers, which actually Kaya kind of organized and came up with the idea. So everybody wrote 3 minutes or less, exploring this idea of virtuosity now in the 21st century for solo violin in relation to Paganini and the 24th Caprice. And so we just premiered 32 of those works in May, I think, at the New York Phil Biennial. So everything kind of came full circle in the end, which is nice. And it turned into a creative project in the end. So it was torture, then became a really nice project with many friends. So.
Well, some of our Aspen locals will know or perhaps even remember that Benjamin Britten was given an Aspen Gold Medal in the mid-60s, and he came and gave a talk. One of the things he said is that he thinks it's a tremendous advantage to a composer to write for a particular player, and to have in mind the particular circumstances, even down to the hall where the music will be played. And he asserted that a work has more chance of living universally if it is born very particularly. And I know that throughout your career you have worked with a small group of extraordinary artists that really collaborate with you almost. I don't know if you would comment on that.
Well, composer's work is very, very lonely work, as you know yourself, and every composer is creating their own language, and which is not so easy to approach for any performer. And I have learned little by little that first of all to write for somebody, it's very inspiring. But then, yes, to collaborate and to be sure that the first performances, I always try to be sure that there is somebody who already knows my music, because it really radiates to the orchestra. If it's, for example, well, here in the rehearsals, Jenny has given so much for the young musicians who didn't even know that I exist or didn't know about my music. So it's just very big advantage, and it breaks the ice. And often if I have a orchestra premiere with an orchestra who never played my music before, I try to get a conductor, maybe not famous, but wonderful, which is not always easy, that I really try to get some of my musicians to be there. It brings so much for the music.
Jenny, so you just had these 32 world premieres at once. Did you go back and forth with those composers at all? Did you ever say, would you consider X or Y?
Well, considering that I think the last piece came in less than 24 hours before the premiere, that there wasn't that much back and forth before the initial world premieres. At least 50% delivered before that point. But I wanted to reference to what Kaya was saying a little bit about her music, because I think that there are composers that you kind of look back at historically now, that you can say, I was thinking even last night at the Beethoven recital, that there's certain key composers that are we look at as kind of these points of revolution, right? And that kind of push forward music, or if you think about like 12-tone music. And I was thinking it's been really wonderful working with the students here, because there is a very unique language to Kaya's music. And I think what it has to do with is finding new places of expressivity. So kind of reaching beyond what had been thought of before physically for instruments or in terms of musical expression. And so that's been really a lovely process to kind of have with the students, because it's no longer that soltasto is just over the fingerboard. It's an expressive tool. It's no longer that ponticello is just like this noise of the bridge. It's an expressive tool. So. And what I love also about Fries, because that's specifically in Grawl, but in Fries it's about, again, kind of expanding that musical palette and that possibility for expressivity. And I think it's very significant, because that's the entire point of music, is what we say and how we can communicate with other human beings. And so that's, for me as a performer, playing her music is very compelling. And I enjoy living in that world, because it's really about finding so much space to find that kind of unique voice. But referring back, I can't remember what you asked about. No, sorry.
No, that was a perfect answer. So a different form of collaboration. We have Fries is one of the works this evening. And it is inspired or connected to visual art of Odilon Redon, friezes. And also this evening, Grawl Theater, which is inspired or related to a series of contemporary plays in French. Then on Friday, we have a suite, if you will, derived from the opera L'Amour de Loin, I can't say it, L'Amour de Loin, which is, of course, a literary collaboration. So to what degree do you feel your work has connection to other forms of artistic expression?
Well, I don't know, because Fries, for example, the starting point is musical. So what can one possibly compose after Chacon? It's a horrible challenge. And how to take that D and then develop a piece out of it. So there I had ideas in my mind. I had an idea to add electronics. So at least something new, something different. And then I happened to go to see a big exhibition of Odilon Redon in Paris. And that, this is how it often happens. So there is some music in my mind. And then when I was looking these friezes, or how do you say in English?
Friezes.
With different colors, so somehow the ideas, I could focus my ideas, and that's how it often happens. And then I go to on my table and start writing. It's music then. I don't think about in fact anymore that connection. But it has happened several times this way. And also when I have been reading something, either the text really invites music, or then there is something that gives the idea. But often it's so that the music is already, you know, it's already coming on surface. It has it somewhere there, and then
I realized the ideas.
Well, I was at the dress rehearsal this morning, and it struck me that in Grau Theater, you as the soloist are almost an actress. It's a very dramatic work, and I don't know if you think in your own preparation about character, or is it purely technical, musical technical?
Oh, I don't think I ever think technically. Yeah, I think it's just about trying to... Also, I mean, the thing that's nice about working with the students is because it's about communicating always intention. So it's always about musical intention and then just thinking musically. Because I think so often when we... Or I hope I don't do this, but so often oftentimes when we approach contemporary music, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, or, you know, we're in 7, like how do we like divide this, and how do we just make sure we're together and not have a, you know, a catastrophe crash. And I think they're doing this great, is that we just think musically, you know, I'll use weird examples, but for example, like Kyle will go back and forth between a dotted eighth and then a 16th, or sometimes she has triplet figures, and they have very different musical meanings, you know. But we would naturally do that, like if it was Mozart or Brahms, or because we're just familiar with that language. So, but as soon as the students knew that, they've been really wonderful and so responsive. So it's even things like that, or with coloration of Ponticello, that there can be a beauty with overtones, even in pianissimo, with Ponticello. And I think usually, traditionally, we've seen it as, forte Ponticello. And then sol tosto also, the kind of bell-like sound that can happen in sol tosto. So it's, I think the rehearsal process is really, of course, there's the coordination things, but it's mostly been about, like, let's really explore this palette, that there's not just black and white possibilities. There's, like, an entire world and spectrum. And if you felt like the edge of the coloration on your instrument, like, ended at the stage, it actually goes far beyond. And that's exciting to see also, young students discovering this whole world. Because, you know, it might have just been like piano and forte, and maybe you had traditionally dolce with a couple sforzandos. And then, you know, when you can think that there's like an entire other world, it's very exciting.
Well, Grau Theater is in two movements which are continuous. The first is marked delicate, and the second impetuous. And throughout the piece, in so many ways, there's a sense of duality, of dichotomy. How is the rhetoric of its being a concerto managed? Because I think whenever one begins writing a concerto, there's a question, how does the soloist relate to the orchestra? Is it contrary? Is it unified? Is it leading? Is it following? And I wondered if you would comment on the rhetoric of the solo and the ensemble parts.
Yes, Grau Theater is the first concerto I've written, and it was a big step for me, especially because I love violin so much, and I know so many beautiful concertos, so it was difficult to break the ice. These two parts, I see very much the first part being violin being like a guide through a nearly landscape, and like lighting the way. So it's much more linear than the second one, which in my mind I was calling broken mirrors, and where then there start to be really contrasting elements more clearly, and there is a kind of fight between the orchestra and the violin. So, yeah.
And how about you? You've talked about working with the students and sort of communicating with them in intention, but do you feel you are leading them, or do you feel it's a struggle, or...
Oh, no. I don't know. I think just... I always think it's about process. Like the performance is just like the tiny part of the process. And you know, I think also in the music itself, it's always about that process of change, of color change, of rhythmic change, of moving forward, of pulling back, of dynamic change and stuff like that. So it's always about the actual journey. That makes no sense. I'm just only speaking metaphorically, I'm sorry.
No, metaphor is good. talk about the virtuoso requirements. It's a tremendous workout, this piece, and it does range from delicate and absolutely beautiful to impetuous to almost violent at times. And how was your approach to learning it?
I feel like Alex one time, he was like, oh, but don't you go into every performance just being hysterical? I was like, oh, yeah, that's true. I think, my very first process in general, I don't do this now because I know Kaya's music, but I think going into the first performance that I ever did of Graal, I do this with almost every composer. It's like I just do total immersion. So I don't just look at like the violin pieces that they wrote, or even just the concerti. It's like I try to cover everything. So symphonies, chamber music, stuff like that, just so that you can have that kind of, you begin to understand their language, and then sometimes in terms of time periods also in their lives, if you know, they're passed away, which is true of a lot of classical musicians, composers, but, you know, you kind of see what kind of surrounding musical world is in that time period for those composers. So in general, that's basically what I do. And I annoy publishers because I'll just ask them for piles of like 50 pounds of scores. And I just study scores. So that's kind of the first step, and just to be in that world. And then it's just once you kind of understand the language, and then it's just learning stuff. I mean, just physically learning stuff.
To me, a remarkable thing about this work, it involves 19 other players and a conductor. Very, very complex and yet transparent. One hears everything. And in fact, in the rehearsal this morning, that was one of the things being worked on, was to balance and adjust everything. It's rather a general question, but can you talk about the idea of transparency in terms of what you strive for in a very large ensemble?
Well, I when I imagine the music, when I imagine my music, I want to hear everything. So when I write it down, I want that the music is heard. I don't want that there are some theoretical reasons to do something. The what is most important is the music which we hear in the end. I work really carefully with dynamics, and that's very painful work because every hall is different anyway. And Harry's hall, which is so beautiful, is very favorable for high frequencies, and there is very nice wooden wall behind the musicians. So those musicians who are near to the wall, their playing reflects very strongly to the hall. So, and every hall is different. So that's what we were doing very much. And I all the time remind the young musicians that there is diminuendo. I write diminuendo. That means that I want it to happen. But that's something that is not so much used, I realize. So people, they use dynamics and they like to do crescendos, but they don't like to do diminuendos.
Well, I love that you talk about Harris.
Everybody wants to accelerate in a car.
I love your mention of Harris Hall, because the work on the first half this evening, Freeze, is for a violin soloist with electronics. And the electronics involve speakers that are deployed around the hall. They create a three-dimensional effect in the sound. I hasten to say it is not loud, because sometimes people see the speakers and go, oh my gosh, it's going to be too loud. It's actually extraordinarily delicate effects that happen. But it's three-dimensional, and you feel the hall. As someone who's in Harris Hall multiple times a day, I felt the hall in a completely different way, listening to the work. But I thought, because so much of your work does involve electronic means, I thought you might say a few words about the interaction of the live musician and the computer.
Yes, well, I am now in this high age, so I have composed long time, and the electronics have changed very much during my professional life. Then, of course, there was one early work a couple of days ago, and this Freeze is one of my last works, and it's my last work with electronics. So technology has also become much more refined, or the refinement is possible today. Why I started to work with electronics was that I was so frustrated of the halls where my music was played when I was young. When I was a student, we used to have concerts in an art hall, which was had horrible acoustics. And I always looked for precision, because I was looking for these tiny color changes, but then also to have some kind of generosity what comes to the resonance. And that means a very good hall, and there are not so many of them, in fact. So that's why I went for the first time to the studio. I started amplifying instruments, and then adding reverberation, for example, to have that precision in the instrument. Then over these more than 30 years now, I've done a lot of work with electronics, very different kinds of works, with a lot of work with computers, with analyzing sounds, which I wanted to understand more about sound, and why I love some of them. Could there be some objective reason? Could there be some physical reason? So I wanted to learn much about sound, about natural sounds, which I also use sometimes in my music. So all that has also brought ideas and influences in my instrumental writing.
Well, there are many important electronic and acoustic combinations in which the live player is playing with a recording, and thus the recording is fixed. But in this case, it's very interactive.
Yes, I don't like doing stuff like that. I don't like following a click at all. No, but this is very nice, because it's first of all, Kaya does the mixing, and then it's always triggered by myself, so it feels very much like that the liveness of the performance is significant, that it's not just that every performance is in the same tempo, but we actually adjust to the hall, for example, or the resonance, or, you know, sometimes you just feel a certain moment in a slightly longer way or a shorter way, and you just want to drive forward a little more or not. It's very nice, because it's like making music. It really is making music, but you're not stuck on a click track.
For the opera that we're doing on Friday, I wondered if you would comment on writing for voice, and whether you feel differences, or whether you feel a tremendous commonality in instrumental writing and vocal writing.
I think it's completely different. The voice comes from body, and that makes it so special. even if you would have very detailed notation for the voice, every voice is so different, and every person is so different, every singer is so different. So I can write delicato, espressivo, or furioso, but then everybody, of course it's same also with the instrumentalists, but human voice, as you know, we communicate so much just by our voice. You know that if we write emails, they can be very easily misunderstood, because somebody can think that, oh, there she has been very angry. Whereas if I would have spoken at phone, I could have said very calmly and nicely these same things. So we just communicate with voice so many things, so I think it's same in music. And then text. If you use texts, then you create completely another level of communication. So there is always the music, but then there is the text, and then there is the interpretation of the text. So I think it's wonderful. I love voice, but it's differently very complicated also.
Actually, I had meant before that to see if we might hear just a fragment, a few minutes, from Fries. I think you have a recording. And just to give you an idea, and so what you're hearing is a live performer, well, now a recorded live performer, but the performer, there's a software, and there's an engineer who will be working in live with the performer, but what the performer does is being repeated, being amplified, being doubled at an octave, following the tempo changes sometimes, I think.
Oh, yeah, the electronics are actually literally responding, mm-hmm. And it's live processed, which was very exciting to me, because it really has everything to do with being in the moment, you know, in a live performance. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, so all the sounds come from Jenny. Yeah. Also, if you come to the concert, the last movement, which where you hear very, very low instrument following Jenny's playing, so that low instrument is Jenny,
and it's processed in the moment. I don't know anything about computers.
But I was thinking just to play the beginning of the second movement.
That gives an idea of it, but thank you. You know, I'm thinking in a different series this summer. We've been thinking a lot about acoustics. Oh, pardon?
No, sorry. I think that was my recording. I was like, oh, I took it slower.
Ah.
Yeah.
I think I play it faster now.
But we've been thinking about properties of sound in a different series, as I say. So the double reed instruments have a very pure sound. It's almost pure tone. That is, if you think of signal-to-noise ratio. And whereas the stringed instruments are at the other extreme, and they have a tremendous complexity in the sound. And I just feel in this piece, it's like an essay on the property of the violin sound. It amplifies it in a sense.
Yeah, well, violin is like the most precious jewel, but which you can then reflect on light, and you get all these fantastic fragile colors, and that's of course which is the big step for the students when they have been working for 15 years to keep the bow straight and have their beautiful vibrato and this sound, their good sound. So to not to feel offended, to open that into the other possibilities.
Now, you mentioned students, and you have been extraordinarily generous in your visit to Aspen in working with our composing students. And I thought we'd switch gears from your music to, as a teacher, what is your approach? You open a score that you've never seen from a person you have never known, and you have to say something in a very short amount of time. How is that?
Well, it's very interesting because these are people I have not met before, but most often, all very talented, by the way. And they are following with their teacher their studies. So I try to give a very like large spectrum of remarks what I can give to them to have feedback. And of course I want to be positive, but of course I want to give criticism also. And in fact what I do, I read the score, or if there's a recording we listen to it together, and then I try to react from my experience as a composer, but also as a listener. That what I hear, is this what was their intention? Because when you are young, you don't yet have this possibility to that skill to go in and out from your own score. And I think it's extremely important to learn to be your first listener and evaluate your music. Is this really what I wanted to do? Am I happy? Because we have so many ideas, and as you know, we need to have technical tools to write the music. And when you are young, sometimes these tools take over, and you create a process, but firstly, you should break it at some point, or you should really just let your intuition decide what to do. But it's so difficult to find this balance, and that's what I try often to point. You know, I don't know if there are so many other so complicated human things as artistic work, you know, composition, where you need to be so sensitive and so open to your inner desires, and you need to be so strict and controlled in your technique. It's like Jenny with her violin. It's when you think about all the time that the human, and she has still the physicality, of course, which we composers don't have. So I think that's already one reason to appreciate art.
Well, I'll just offer an anecdote which I think follows that. My own teacher would say that his role was to try to get me to approach the music in an objective way as well as a subjective way. And once I knew him quite well, I remember one lesson where I brought in my music and I set it in front of us and we were both looking at it, but I was trying to imagine what he was seeing instead of trying to imagine what I had put there. And after about 20 minutes of silence, I just took it away. I said, I'll fix that.
Yeah, but that's exactly what we need to learn to do.
Yeah. We have a few minutes, and if you have comments or questions, since we're recording this for broadcast, I would just ask that you wait for someone to come and give you a microphone. But I think we have our microphone ready, so... Yes, over here.
Thanks. Sorry. I was a few minutes late, so I may have missed this, but it's certainly a big week for Finnish music with our loss of Rautava Aara. And I was just wondering if you have any thoughts or comments about his legacy.
About Eino Juhani?
Yes.
I was never studying with Eino Juhani Rautavaara. Of course, he was a very important figure in Finnish music. He was also the composition professor at Sibelius Academy for a long time. On the other hand, he was, as you know, if you know his music, he was stylistically very pluralistic. So also as a teacher, what I understand, but I don't have experience on that. So he was able to help people coming from very very different kinds of backgrounds. He was very particular composer, but so I never was very much in touch with him. So I don't think I can say anything much more interesting about him. Of course, fantastic composer.
And down here.
Hello. It's generally general knowledge in Europe that the finest general education is Finnish, and also that Finland is very well known for its musical education. I wonder if you could speak to that. It's extraordinary that so much quality is coming out of Finland.
That's true, and I hope it will stay that way, but nothing is less sure, because it's true that during my youth, a music education system was created by just some people who really had the passion and willpower. And the music school system was created all over the country, where people are living quite sparsely. But the system, first of all, was accessible for everybody, not depending on their financial situation, but also very high level, and was much in connection, the teachers were in connection with Sibelius Academy. So it took maybe 10 years and we fantastic Finnish singers started to be known, conductors, composers, players of all instruments, and especially the singers, many of them came from some small town or foreign village of Finland. And then what comes to general education, I think that too was created at that time. I think it has been easy because the population has been very uniform. So that has maybe, and there are not so many Finnish people either, but it's true that there has been a trust for a child. They don't start the teaching. You know, I have been living in France for 30 years, and unfortunately, or maybe also fortunately, my children grew up there. But you know, in France, you go to school when you are 3, and you better start reading quite soon. In Finland, you go to school when you are 6, 7, and before that, you can have your childhood in all peace. At least that's how it was before. And then the school days are not very long, and there is a lot of time for children to grow also otherwise than to learn the school skills. So I think fantastic things have happened there. And in all these discussions, they have Finland has been number one, but I'm afraid it's not anymore. And this kind of culture, internet, all that, it's taking a little bit place of the most important things.
Rachel?
Well, I'm a third generation American Finn, so I'm very much involved. But I wanted to comment about Rautavaara. I used to coordinate the Performer of the Year program for Finlandia Foundation National, and one of the first performers, was Ulla Suokko, who played the Rautavaara flute concerto, which stays in my mind as one of the most spectacular works, and just because of being involved with it. And it was also played in Minnesota, a guy by the name of Johnson, but Finn was the conductor for that. But you didn't mention on conductors, you didn't mention Jorma Panula, who seems to have been the one who trained so many of the conductors in Finland.
Yes, you're right, of course, yes. The school of Jorma Panula has been decisive for the all this generation of Finnish conductors who are now known very much also in this country.
Now we have time for just the briefest of comments.
There was the lady.
Oh, okay. Well, either way.
When you spoke about inspiration, with these young composers, what do they write their own music, and do they get inspired by what comes from their inner soul, or do they take a look at the world and what is going on in today's society?
Well, I think we are, you know, everybody have their own starting points, of course, and when you are young, I think you also get inspired by the music you hear or you study. But of course, I think every composer must have a very deep starting point already to want to be a composer and to want to express yourself in music. So there is firstly always something very personal, and then it depends on the character, whether you open yourself to the world or whether you get your inspiration around you. And I think it's always at some degree it is, because music is communication.
Okay, we'll just have one more quickly.
Thank you. As someone at the forefront of contemporary music and as a mentor to young musicians, what is something that you wish that all young musicians considered when approaching their craft?
As performers or as composers?
Both.
Both. Well, I hope that they find a way to trust themselves and realize that there is only one of all of us. And even if I think that's the frightening thing today with internet and everything, that you know there we have a feeling, and which is true, that there are thousands of composers, and then the young people today, they feel really stressed, and how can I have place in this world, and what is the recipe to have the success? Some young people can ask me what should I do to be as successful as you are, and so the only advice can be that be yourself, that there is only one you, and to find from you the motivation and the vision, think about the musicians you love. You love them because they are personal. So you are personal too. So how to find that personality and trust to it, because we are very lonely. We are very exposed. I'm exposed when my music is on the stage and played and in the hands of performers. If people don't know my music, they judge my music through that performance. So it was bad piece or good piece, depending how it's performed. And then performers, when they play contemporary music, so maybe they are not judged similarly, but when they then play the Tchaikovsky concerto or sing something that everybody knows, then of course, then we are judging them as persons. So, but what is the most interesting thing? The interesting thing is that we hear something genuine, something which is coming from you as a human.
So thank you. That's a perfect place to close. 8:30 this evening in Harris Hall, Jennifer Coe's recital, and 6 p.m. Friday in the tent, Sibelius and Sarajevo. I'm so grateful to Jennifer Coe and Kaya Sarajevo.
Thank you.